Thanks for listening in here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, and we're turning our attention now to Native Americans' contributions here in Wisconsin to the Civil War as we visit with Russell Horton. Russell is the reference and outreach archivist at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. Great pleasure to have him with us today. You may have some questions about Native American involvement during the Civil War. And I hope you do. Did you even realize that they served in the Civil War? What questions might you have? Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Just go there. And we'd look forward to hearing from you. And Russ Horton, thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you for having me.
What were relations like between Wisconsin's white and Native populations back at the time, 1861, when the war started?
Sure. Well, it was a hard time. The United States government had been implementing their Indian policy, which sort of consisted of trying to push the tribes west of the Mississippi. Specifically in Wisconsin, the Ho-Chunk were being pushed into Minnesota. The Menominee in, 1856 had almost been put into Minnesota, but managed to maintain their reservation. So they were also at the same time being encouraged to abandon their traditional ways and start engaging in agriculture, take up Christianity, things like that. And the reservations in Wisconsin tended to be on the poorest farmland in the state. So this sort of provided quite a problem for the reservations. So going into the Civil War, 1860-1861, conditions for Native Americans in Wisconsin were not fantastic.
Not great, for sure. And they were not subject to the draft because of their sovereign status. So all of those who served, they either volunteered or they were paid to take the place of others, I think. Is that right?
That's exactly right. They were not, honestly, they weren't allowed to serve officially until 1863, although some managed to get in anyway. But no, they were not subject to the draft. They all volunteered.
And did participation in the Union forces provide some, was there some cultural benefit, if anything, to our Wisconsin tribes? For some of them, at least, men proving themselves through warfare was an important element, I would guess.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can't generalize for everyone, but certainly some were able to kind of take back this cultural tradition going back to pre-contact of gaining prestige and honor on the battlefield. As part of the Indian policy, any sort of fighting or battle was strongly discouraged by the U.S. government. So they had lost this important part of their traditions. And definitely, I think, for some of the men from these tribes, they saw enlisting in the Union Army as a chance to regain this cultural tradition and gain standing and honor and prestige on the battlefield.
So that might have been an element, at least, for them to enlist or enroll, because you wonder why, when with all of the sort of negative lost land, lost status.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. I studied this a bit and tried, that was the question I came into this study with, was why in the world would these men volunteer to fight for a country that had basically been trying to dispossess them of their lands and take away their culture. And the warrior ethic or warrior tradition was one of the reasons. Some of the other reasons I was able to uncover included sheer economics, because the reservations were so poor, because they weren't able to gain money other ways. They saw these enlistment bonuses and substitution bonuses as a great way to bring money into their families and their tribes. Although they didn't always see the United States as honoring the treaties that they signed with them, from the Native perspective, they honored the treaties that they signed with the U.S., and they saw supporting them in military affairs as an important part of validating those treaties. So one of the reasons also was just that they felt it was their obligation to support the U.S. in their wars.
How'd you study that, by the way? You said you researched that.
Sure. Well, I was in college here at the UW in Madison, and trying to figure out what to write my undergrad thesis on, and I knew I really enjoyed Native American history. I enjoyed the Civil War, and just kind of put the two together. And while I started researching, I found out that there isn't really a whole lot out there on it. So I had to go to a lot of different sources, and I got to talk to the tribal historians for several of the tribes in Wisconsin, visit their reservations and look at their records. It was really interesting. I think it's a fascinating story.
It certainly is. And we had, out of a total, what was the population, Native population was about 9,000 at the time,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, that's the best number that I could find. Again, since there hasn't been a whole lot of study on the topic, and because it can be difficult to identify individual Native Americans in the Civil War muster rolls, it's kind of guesswork at best. But yeah, the total population was about 9,000, and I found estimates of about 500 to 600 who served, which is...
That's a pretty good percentage.
It's 5 to 6%, which is a little under the general service percentage of the state of Wisconsin. But when you, as you mentioned earlier, when you take into account the fact that they were not under any sort of obligation to serve, I think it's very impressive.
And in fact, we're told and weren't supposed to serve for quite a long time.
Right. Actually, so Fort Sumter was fired on April 12, 1861. 3 days later, Lincoln calls for volunteers. The next day, Governor Randall in Wisconsin makes a call for volunteers in Wisconsin. Less than a month later, the governor receives a letter from a man named Robert Greeno up in the Fox Cities who offers 200 Menominee men to serve in the Union Army. And at that time, the state decides, as long as we've got so many volunteers coming in, white volunteers, let's not worry about Native Americans right now. And that lasted as long as they had a lot of volunteers. In 1862, as the war lengthened, as it became obvious that the war was not going to be short, and as the casualties started rising, volunteers dried up. And again, the state kind of looked into it. Governor Edward Salomon wrote to Washington in August of 1862 and asked the Secretary of War, "We have these volunteers from our tribes. Should we take them in?" And they were told flat out by Washington at that time, no. And so it wasn't until 1863 that the United States decreed that quote-unquote colored troops would be allowed to serve in the Union Army, which most of us, when we hear that, we think of African-American troops, but that also included Native American troops. So 1863 is when they were first officially allowed to serve.
And why, again, what was the federal government's reasoning for not allowing?
I don't know all of the reasons behind it. I think it was probably a pretty politically charged idea to let... the color. I mean, again, I think this mostly, the rule mostly applied to African Americans, and there were a lot of politics involved in that, but Native Americans were included in the concept of colored troops. And I think that it just got so desperate for the Union when you get into 1863 and they needed men, and they've
been losing a lot, a lot of battles in that first couple of years.
And the volunteers were drying up, and they were facing the reality of a draft, which was not a very popular thing. So they wanted to avoid that at all costs. So allowing colored troops to enlist, they hoped would put off the draft or at least lessen the amount of draft they would have to do.
Russell Horton, our guest today. Russ is the reference and outreach archivist at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. Talking with him today about Native American involvement in the Civil War. Questions about the war, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us as well at talk@wpr.org, or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can post a question there. And while I'm mentioning the Vets Museum, what do we have there that we can see that relates to Native American involvement? Or just, frankly, let's talk the Civil War in general.
Sure. Well, I think I can answer both of those in one fell swoop here. This past Saturday, July 2nd, we just opened a new Civil War exhibit called From Paper to Iron, which traces Wisconsin's entry into the Civil War, 1861 and 1862. It includes some original battle flags. It includes musical instruments. I heard those mentioned in the last segment. It has a a little section on Bruin the bear, who was a black bear, adolescent black bear that the 12th Wisconsin brought around with them as a mascot, kind of like Old Abe, but a little scarier. And it includes, which I think is just fantastic, an interactive touch table, which is kind of like a giant iPad that you can use to bring up hundreds of Civil War images, pictures of flags, battle maps, and included in that are two pictures, at least I know of Native Americans who served in Wisconsin units from the 19th Wisconsin.
Very cool. The black, and you're going to have to tell me some more about the black bear because I, it's a story I don't know, and we'll get to that. we'll get to that story, but I want to get Jeremy and Kashina on first. Jeremy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Good afternoon.
What's on your mind?
Well, I was hoping that your guest could tell us what the Menominee Nation's presence was during the Civil War, if there was like a regiment just for Menominees.
Well, there wasn't a whole regiment, but the Menominee did have almost an entire company. In the Civil War, there were regiments that were about 1,000 men, and each regiment had 10, infantry regiment at least, had 10 companies that were made up of about 100 men. And Company K of the 37th Wisconsin Infantry had about 40 Menominee men in them. It included some non-commissioned officers, sergeants, and corporals, and I'm not able to confirm it 100%, but I heard that the reason there were non-commissioned officers was because they had to translate orders from English into Menominee. Now, these men served in the Eastern Theater. They were at the Siege of Petersburg. They were involved in one of the more unique incidents in the Civil War, the Battle of the Crater, or Petersburg Mine, where they suffered incredibly heavy casualties. And they continued with Grant's army till the end of the war, participated in the Grand Review in Washington at the end of the war, and just really had exemplary service.
Excellent.
Thank you.
Yeah, Jeremy, for calling. Appreciate your call. Talking about Native American involvement in the Civil War with Russell Horton of the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. He'll be with us right up until 12:30 today. Again, join in with your questions and comments here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're zeroing in on the Civil War today, and in particular on Native American participation in the Civil War, especially those from Wisconsin. Our guest today, Russ Horton, is reference and outreach archivist at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. Great to have him along, and thank you so much for listening in. Lots of callers online right now, so I think we'll go right to the phones. And Maddie in Oneida, we turn to you first. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. I'd like to know how many Oneidas were involved, and if there weren't too many of them, what their names were.
Well, how long is the show, Larry? the number that I was able to come up with in my studies was about 111 Oneida.
Oh, my goodness. I didn't know that.
It's very good. And I think there is a list that I believe the nation has with a lot of the names on it. But the Oneida were pretty prominent in the 14th Wisconsin. There were about 50 between Companies F and Company G. Who served in the Western Theater, kind of Vicksburg, and I think they participated in the Battle of Atlanta, the Battle of Nashville. And there's a really good reminiscence written by a guy named Elisha Stockwell, who was in the 14th. And he mentioned several times in his reminiscence that the fact that there were so many Native Americans in Company F and Company G. He doesn't specifically mention Oneida, but when you start researching the company, you can see that they're all Oneida. But yeah, the Oneida, definitely a very proud record as well in the Civil War.
All right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Where would Maddie find that list of names?
Well, she could contact me at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, and I could definitely get her that list.
Okay, did you catch that, Maddie?
Yes.
All right. So, and I would assume just go to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum website.
Absolutely.
There's a
staff contact list right on there, so you can get a hold of me.
All right. There you go, Maddie. Thank you very much for calling. And Robin in Platteville, on to you now. Hi, Robin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My husband's great-great-grandfather served in the Civil War. We have an old picture of him with a group of men in uniform, including a Native American. My question is that we have had a very hard time going through any official resources to find out what regiment or unit he was in. The family always thought he served with a Wisconsin unit, but we've not, you know, getting on Ancestry.com and whatnot, we can't find any records, though he did receive a homestead for his service in the Civil War. I was wondering if I brought this photograph into the historical museum, would we be able to find some sort of clue as to what unit or regiment this was with? Because I can't find any, you know, markings on the photograph as to that either.
Sure. As long as you have his name and a little bit of information about him, you can either contact me by email, or if you want to bring the photo into the Wisconsin Veterans Museum, I'd be happy to help you. It's possible that he served in a Wisconsin unit. Names got misspelled pretty horribly during the Civil War, so that might be one of the reasons that you're having trouble finding him. But we have a lot of different resources that can help you find ancestors. And even if he didn't serve in a Wisconsin unit, we can either help you find him in another state or at least point you in the right direction to finding him. But that's absolutely something that I do every day at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. So I'd be happy to help you with that.
Well, because I was going to be in Madison next week, and maybe I could
stop by.
And if it's a photograph that you're interested in, we could scan it into the computer. And then you guys would have that for your archives, too.
Yeah, definitely something we could talk about.
Yeah, and the Veterans Museum is located on the Capitol Square, so it's...
Yeah, it's right where State Street runs into the Capitol, so you can do half a day of shopping and half a day of checking out our new museum.
All right, thank you very much.
All right, thanks, Robin. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. And let's turn to Dan and Mosinee next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, thanks for the program. I've done a little research on the 37th and 38th Wisconsin, and I've got a letter that was published in the Washera Argus newspaper on July 24, 1864, about another Wisconsin Eagle that connects with Company K that you mentioned that had so many Menominee soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And the letter, just a short part of it, says, "The arrival of Company K has brought the effective strength of the regiment to 330 men. Not the least notable is the arrival of, late at these headquarters, Ulysses S. Grant, Esquire, not the general of that name, but a young eagle which the boys of Company K have brought from the state. He's a fine specimen of the American eagle, about 10 weeks of age, and even at his early age measures over 7 feet between the tips of his wings. He was a present to the regiment by Mrs. Joseph Smith of Hudson, St. Croix County, and is quite a pet among the men." And I never heard anything about that eagle anywhere, and I'm wondering if you ever did.
Not until this very moment.
No.
That's pretty interesting. I had heard of, there was another eagle in addition to Old Abe. I think the 49th Wisconsin had a golden eagle who eventually was named Andy Johnson. But no, I've never heard of Ulysses S. Grant. That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's in the July issue of the Washera Argus newspaper. And my other question was prompted by research I did on a veteran buried in the Mosinee Cemetery who was a Native American who was in Company E of the 38th and had his fingers blown off in the crater at Petersburg and collected his pension here. And he was from Black Flambeau. So I'm wondering if the 38th recruited more Chippewa or members from the tribes in that area.
I don't think I can answer that at this time. My particular focus was on the Green Bay tribes, the Oneida, Stockbridge, Muncie, and Menominee, just because they had the best records at the time. I have been looking into Ojibwe and Ho-Chunk and Brothertown and Potawatomi a little more lately, but they didn't, at least to my research, they did not enlist in such large groups. So they're a little harder to track down. But the fact that there was someone in the 38th from Lac des Flambeaux is a good sign.
Dell, thanks very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And I should point out that we have the article from that you wrote from Wisconsin Magazine of History. What's the title is Unwanted in a White Man's War, the Civil War Service of the Green Bay Tribes.
That's correct.
Green Bay Tribes.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've got that out. If you want to go to the Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, you can find that. And essentially what we're talking about is what you're writing about.
Yeah. Again, this is something I studied. I'm going to feel old here, about 10 years ago. just really fascinating. And with the sesquicentennial going on, it's a good thing to revisit. I think it's an important part of Wisconsin's Civil War story.
Absolutely. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@WPR.org. Or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show and post a question or comment. Let's go to Larry in Sturgeon Bay next. Larry, hello to you.
Hi there. Lucky enough to have a photograph of a relative there from the Civil War, Stockbridge Munsee Band of the Mohicans. And also, I heard you guys making the comment, why would anybody want to fight for the country? But they already knew they could count on both the Mohicans and the Oneidas that they had fought for the Americans in both the Revolutionary War and the War of 1812. So it wasn't an unusual thing. And then the other day on the History Channel, I happened to see that a company of Oneidas was with Sherman on his march north from the south. Thank you very much.
Uh-huh. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, that's a great point to raise, and one that I did explore a little bit in my research was just the tradition of supporting the U.S., particularly, as the caller mentioned, the Oneida and Stockbridge Munsee, who started out on the East Coast. They both fought with the Americans in the Revolution and kind of continued, even as they were pushed west, continued supporting the U.S.
Thanks again, Larry, for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have an email from Ann. Do you have any information about the tribes that joined the Confederacy, believing that sovereignty was a shared fight? Apparently the red star on some Confederate flags was to represent the bands fighting with the Confederacy. Were they effective, or did you do any research in that area?
I didn't look into Natives supporting the Confederacy very much. I focus mostly on Wisconsin, but I do know just in kind of skimming through various sources that there were certainly tribes that supported the Confederacy. Some of them were slaveholders themselves. And I would guess that there might have been some thought that South's fighting for states' rights. If they win, maybe we'll get a little better treatment. And actually, speaking of the South, that leads into something maybe we can talk about a little as well.
Sure.
In 1862, in Minnesota, there were some members of the Dakota tribe who killed some white settlers in August of 1862, and this set forth this gigantic scare in Wisconsin. And one of the thoughts was that Southerners were trying to incite tribes in Wisconsin to fight while the army was away. And this is kind of another reason I found that enlistment began increasing amongst the Wisconsin tribes, because they hadn't done anything.
Yeah.
And there's all these people questioning their loyalty and assuming that they're traitors. And one of the best ways for them to prove their loyalty was to enlist in the Union Army.
What you mentioned, Company K, and the native portion of that, well, like everybody else in that company, suffered significantly in the Battle of the Crater.
Mm-hmm. The Crater is really...
miserable thing.
It's something that is almost... You wouldn't believe it if it was in a movie. You know, you'd watch it. That's
it wasn't a movie.
Right. But basically, the Union had Petersburg, the city of Petersburg in Virginia, under siege and weren't able to break the Confederate lines. And one of the ideas they came up with was to have some Pennsylvania miners dig a tunnel underground to under the several hundred yards to under the Confederate lines, plant about 4 tons of explosives. And the thought was they'd blow that It would create a gigantic hole in the line. It would create confusion, and the Union forces would rush in and break the siege. They had been training an African-American unit to do this duty. And I believe the day before the explosion, which was July 30th, 1864, a general, I think it was General Meade, just suddenly decided to call an audible, and he removed the African-American unit and inserted another unit, which included men of the 37th Wisconsin. So they were unprepared. I believe they were sent in a little late, and the Confederates in the line had had some time to recover from the shock of the explosion. So the men of the 37th and their compatriots rushed into this hole created by the detonation, and they basically were sitting ducks as the Confederates recovered and shot down on them, and just horrible, horrible casualties.
Gert in New Richmond, we're on to you now. Hi, Gert.
I want to thank your guest. I'm sorry I can't remember his name because I just turned on the radio in time to hear about the fact that Lincoln made it possible for blacks as well as Native Americans to join.
Mm-hmm.
My great-grandfather enlisted and gave his name as George Romer. But 3 years before that, he had married and gave his name as Jatokus Romer.
Mm-hmm.
So, and his daughter told my mother that he was Indian.
Interesting.
Yes, and I have searched for years trying to figure out why he changed his name from Jatokus to George, and I always blamed it on his wife. Because I thought she didn't like the fact that he was Indian. But I guess I was wrong.
It's certainly possible that he changed his name to
in
be
order
able
to be able
enlist.
To enlist.
Yeah, that's possible.
At Camp Chase in Ohio.
Mm.
He was in the 1st Cavalry. Hmm. He enlisted in
1861. Oh. So he was there right in the beginning.
Sure.
Did he make it through?
Oh, yeah, 3 years. And he was mustered out in Louisville, Kentucky.
Hmm.
So
excellent.
He made it through, but I've searched for years, and then I turn on the radio, and there it is.
I'm glad I could help.
Gert, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, of course, anyone with questions like that, the Veterans Museum, that's what you're
absolutely.
Part of your mission.
We're dedicated entirely to acknowledging, commemorating the service of Wisconsin veterans and from the Civil War to the present.
You know, the groups were, the Oneidas, for example, were sort of lumped together into the same company. And so I would think that some people might view that as segregation, as discriminatory, what have you. But I don't think really that was the case.
No, I don't think that was the case. It sort of mirrored the enlistments amongst whites at the beginning of the war. When the Civil War started, people enlisted as almost as communities. I mean, if you look at a company, a random company from the beginning of the Civil War from Wisconsin, you'll find dozens of men from the same city. So men from a community would go to enlist. Once the law changed and Native Americans were allowed to enlist, they kind of did the same thing. And then you add in their whole, the potential for cultural meaning with the warrior ethic. And wanting to probably serve alongside people from their community, you start seeing that. You do see, now the two that I've mentioned, the Menominee in the 37th and the Oneida in the 14th, are the two, by far, the two largest concentrations, 40 and 50 respectively. But yeah, you'll find smaller pockets of men. And I don't think it was the result of segregation at all. I think it was just a product of them enlisting at the same time.
Were there some people or some of the Native Americans who fought in the war who kind of distinguished themselves maybe individually during the war and possibly after the war?
Not that I was, I mean, and not beyond the normal bravery and heroism that men exhibited during the Civil War. I haven't been able to find any household names or men who received particular distinction. But as I've been mentioning, I mean, these men served in horrible battles. There were natives from Wisconsin present at pretty much any battle you can think of in the Civil War. And they, one of the other things that they battled in addition to Southerners were stereotypes. And that kind of ties in with the whole pitched battle thing. There was a gigantic stereotype in the 1860s that Native Americans were scouts and sharpshooters and master woodsmen, but there was also a stereotype that they were not good in pitched battle. And when you think of Gettysburg and Antietam, you think of, you know, two lines lined up and just firing at each other. And the stereotype was that they, Native Americans, were not good at that. They didn't like it. They just weren't good. But looking at the records and researching Wisconsin Indians, that wasn't really the case at all. They were present at all those battles.
And probably not a single person in those battles liked it.
Oh, right. That, there's the thing, too. Like, who does like that?
You're standing 20 feet away from a line of people who are shooting at you, and you stand up and you're shooting back at them.
Mm, exactly.
You can't really like that.
Right, right.
Oh, man. Russell Horton, our guest today here on the Ideas Network, as we talk about Native American participation in the Civil War. Well, is there any lasting effects, or what lasting effects were there from Native American participation in the Civil War?
Sure. Well, when you think of the reasons for enlisting, at least some of them, they included demonstrating their loyalty to the U.S., possibly so that they might receive better treatment after the war. I don't think that their situation was improved at all from their participation in the Civil War. If you trace American Indian history after the Civil War, in 1887, about 20 years after the Civil War, there was the General Allotment Act that affected the Oneida and Stockbridge Munsee. Their reservations were basically eliminated and parceled out into individual plots, something that they're still trying to recover from now. Going into the 20th century, the Menominee fell victim to the Termination Act that eliminated them as a federally recognized tribe, and they, for 20 years, had to fight that. And through all this, they continued to serve in America's military, Spanish-American War, World War One, World War Two, Korea, up through the present. So they've continued to honor this tradition in spite of the fact that it hasn't necessarily improved their lot.
Their allotment. And just thinking about that, and somebody emailed in wondering what was, we talked earlier in the program and in our earlier show about what the home front was like for just the average Wisconsinite. What about for Native Americans? What was the home front like for them?
Well, that, I think, probably similar, possibly worse. Again, I mentioned that they've been encouraged to farm, but their reservations are on incredibly poor farmland. All the men are going away, or not all, but a lot of the men are going away to fight in the war. I think that conditions were not very good. I read through the Bureau of Indian Affairs reports for those tribes during that period. I didn't tend to focus on the home front, but that would certainly be another area of study to look into.
Yeah, well, absolutely. It would be interesting to know. And I want to thank you so much for being with us today. Mm-hmm. And let's go back to the Vets Museum itself and what people are going to be able to see relating to the Civil War.
Sure. Well, again, a new exhibit just opened July 2nd, From Paper to Iron. It just looks at the first 2 years of Wisconsin's participation in the Civil War. And it has some objects that haven't seen the light of day in 100 years. The museum's been around for over 100 years now, and some of those items haven't been on display yet. So there are some things that are just really incredible to see. They have incredible stories behind them. The exhibit really focuses on the stories of the men who relate to the objects. And I think one of the real highlights of it is the interactive touch table that I mentioned that allows you to just bring up images and maps and flags, and you can enlarge them or shrink them. You can pass them across to your friend if you want to show them something. They can spin it around and look at it. It's really just like a giant iPad that multiple people can use at once. It's incredible, but definitely worth coming down to see.
And the museum itself is open.
During the summer, we're open 7 days a week, I believe, and free admission.
Yeah, I know. And it's nice. The best deal going.
Yeah, definitely.
And it's a wonderful place to visit. And I haven't been up for the new exhibit yet, but it just opened. But I'll be there for sure, and you'll see me there. Thank you so much, Russell, for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Appreciate it very much. Russell Horton is the reference and outreach archivist at the Wisconsin Veterans Museum in Madison. It was great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. And just to let you know, tomorrow, time for our monthly visit from UW wildlife ecologist Scott Craven. We'll talk about rising birdseed prices and good news for grouse hunters this fall, wildlife viewing, and more. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.